Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela, and I'm here today with John, and we're excited to finally bring you a series on representing older youth. This is a topic that we've had lots and lots of requests for, and so we've put our heads together and come up with a series that we think will hit a lot of the high points for you. So we're going to start today with just talking about how these cases are different and what permanency looks like for older youth. So John, I'll let you start it off. How are these cases different?
Well, yeah, Angela, this is an important topic because I think it derails a lot of children's attorneys and offices. And the reason is, I think, because it's almost like a completely different job representing older youth versus representing younger youth. Yet some of the same principles apply to both. The principles we've talked about in our other episodes apply to older youth. And we're going to get into that in future episodes. But right now, I think, let's think about it this way. There's that old story, right, of you know, there's someone at the side of the river, and they're pulling babies out of the river, and another person comes up and looks at them and says, "What are you doing?" And they tell them, and they go, "Okay," and they walk away, and they go, "Wait a minute, where are you going? Aren't you going to help me?" And they go, "No, I'm going to go upstream and find out who's throwing the babies in the river." So the person who went upstream to stop the babies from being thrown in the river, that's the children's attorney with the younger kids on their caseload, right? But the person who's pulling the babies out of the river is doing just equally as important work, but it's different, right? It's not to beat the metaphor to death, but going into the water and pulling someone out of it, if you've ever tried to help someone who's drowning or ever been caught in a riptide and tried to help someone, like I personally have been caught in a riptide in the ocean and tried to help someone swim out of it, and you know, you could drown yourself, right? And that's what happens to children's attorneys with older youth. Sometimes you feel like you're actually drowning. So I think recognizing that it's a different type of work is important, because all of us, I think, feel this. Older youth can take up as little maybe as 20% of your caseload, but can take up 80% of your work week, right? So you have to really apply some of our strategies to this population, just like you would the younger population, which is what we focused on a lot. Older youth tend to lead the litigation more so than younger youth, right? And where they lead it is from one crisis to the next to the next. And so there is no strategy. And that's what's really lacking. And I think that's what leads to a lot of the frustration and a lot of the burnout of dealing with this population. So the first thing you need to do is figure out how you're going to handle these cases and how you're going to strategize.
Well, and I think that you've raised the main point, which is that it's so easy for all of the adults to be dragged around by what's going on with the child in the latest crisis and not to have a legal strategy, not to have a real plan for permanence. And I think that's where the children's lawyer really comes in and can keep asking this all-important question. One of the things that we talk about the most is always focusing on the client's core legal problem. The child is in the custody of the state, and they need to be in the custody of a family. And this is true with your older youth as well. You know, what does family mean to that child? And so we want to really start off by talking about how you can still be practicing permanency-driven advocacy with older youth. It will look different, but the principles are the same.
Yeah, and what you need to do is sort of redefine permanency with them, with the older client. And we'll go into detail in future episodes about building trust with them, with the older kid, probably in the next episode. But you know, what does permanency mean to your client, right? I mean, I think we've already talked about how we all bring our own biases about what is a family and to our work. But what about our biases, but what is permanency, right? That word is just full of meaning these days, right? And everyone has their own image that comes to mind when you say permanency. But what does that mean to your client? Probably nothing, right? The word permanency, I mean, mm-hmm. what does that mean to an older teenager? You know, are they still longing for their birth parents on some level? Maybe a relative, maybe a grandparent, maybe a friend's family. Maybe permanency looks like some form of independence for them. So there's a lot of different ways to do this, but the first thing you want to do is meet your client where they are and start talking and trying to get an idea of what they're thinking, what it might mean to them. So be aware that while traditional methods are fine, many older kids find their own family. Okay, so teachers, coaches, like we said, parents of friends or even classmates. Sometimes it's a parent of a boyfriend or a girlfriend. Even that has happened. Other people at church. The more people they're exposed to, the more likely they will find people who might become their permanent family. So it is helpful to make sure that they're being exposed to a wide circle of people and a wide circle of activities, right?
Well, and so that makes perfect sense to me. And I think those of us who practice know that that is true. I wonder for maybe a newer attorney, how do you start that conversation with a child? I know we're going to cover that more later, but I think how do you open their eyes to those possibilities without worrying that we give them a false expectation, like it's going to be easy, but also open their eyes to it so that they can tell you? Is it just in how you question them about the people in their lives, or how do you mine for that, I guess?
I think one of the best ways to do it is to not really approach it head on as, you know, we're going to discuss permanency today, and I want, you know, my job is to find you a family, and let's, you know, let's go tilting at windmills. But I think the more organic way to do it is to enlarge the kid's circle, right? I think we've said this before on other podcasts. I mean, some of our clients have never been to a restaurant where you sit down at a table and be handed a menu. They've never eaten like that in a restaurant before. Some of our clients have never walked on a college campus. They've never belonged to the Girl Scouts or the Boy Scouts. They've never played an organized team sport. So exposing them to different things expands their circle. And then once that's done, the next step, so my clients don't necessarily have to know that I'm doing this because I'm trying to recruit a family for you. I'm doing this for a number of reasons. There's a number of strategic reasons. One side effect of it may be that we encounter people who will be in your life forever, either as a family or not, as adoptive family members or guardians, or just as lifelong mentors and supports. Because the other part of this equation then, and this does require some client, you know, consent, of course, and involvement, is, hey, you know, you really like going to this church and you sing in the choir, but like nobody knows your story. How do you feel about sharing it with the pastor or the choir director or whoever you're close to? Because there might be someone there that would be like, oh my gosh, you know, if I knew that kid weren't going home to mom and dad every day, I might step up. I love that kid, you know? So that's the kind of like organic way that we try to build it for kids. That way they don't realize. It doesn't feel like they're being shopped, right? And I don't want to sound mercenary, but I'm not really shopping them because there's other reasons I'm doing what I'm doing for them as well. It's not just to find a family, right?
No, right. I mean, I think that point of finding something that they really enjoy doing where they're at their best and they're feeling good and they're evolving and building self-confidence, all of the expanding the circle, if it's the right group of people, has, you know, maybe even greater benefits to their well-being, and it's more of a side effect. So I think that's a very actionable thing for attorneys to think about, which is what, what does my client, what is my client interested in? Is there a way to get them involved in something organized where they have regular contact and regular opportunities to do the things they love? And I mean, I have a couple of teenagers right now, and I think sometimes it's hard to even find out what that is. And as an attorney, that may seem overwhelming, but again, just trying different things. Maybe they try a sport and that's not it, but then that leads them a little closer to something that they really enjoy. So I think not, you don't have to know what their life passion is to make progress in this area and to try to find ways to expand the circle, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Right. And I think one thing that works against some older foster youth being able to be involved in more that pro-social activities with perhaps other youth who are more stable is this tag of instability that a lot of our clients carry with them, right? And I think our message today is don't wait for stability, right? The most unstable kid in the world can rapidly settle when they find the right home or when they start to feel like they belong a little bit in something. It doesn't have to be a home, a permanent family that adopts them. Again, we got to shift our thinking a little bit because it is a process towards permanence for these kids. And the destination might look different than what we have in our minds, right? So it's a little bit of a leap of faith here. Just moving forward and seeing what happens, right? I think with the younger kids, we all have two or three destinations in mind, right? Reunification, adoption by some nice family, or permanent guardianship by some nice grandmother or aunt or uncle, right? I mean, we kind of know the three or four different destinations we want for younger youth. With older kids, it gets a little more fluid and requires a little more creativity and a little more faith. The process will work if you implement it with fidelity. With every kid, you just might not. You'll get them there. It might be a different destination than you or they thought they were going to land in. But I do think that the purpose of these activities is not just to recruit people into their lives and try and hope someone will adopt them. It's also to breed stability for them.
And I want to repeat something you just said because I think it's really counter to how people operate, which is you don't have to wait for stability. A lot of these kids don't have a lot of time before they would either, age out if extended foster care isn't an option. And your point that, oftentimes it is the circumstances. I understand, people wanting placements to succeed, but I think an older youth who's ready for a home and has found someone willing. I just don't think that we need to make a barrier, make stability necessary. We should give them a chance to create that in the right environment. And that's something that I heard again and again. And I know people out there hear that all the time. They're not stable enough. It might fail. But sometimes, particularly if you don't have family or close friends as an option. If somebody steps up, you know what? That could be it. That could be the thing that really helps the child start to settle in and figure out who they are. And so we shouldn't hold back those opportunities because we don't feel they're stable enough.
Yeah, I always go back to a teenage girl that I represented, and I remember, I think I've told this story on a previous episode, but I think it bears repeating. She had just been committed to a residential treatment center, and she was not happy about it. We fought it in court, and we lost. And I went to visit her with her, and her therapist was present in the room. And I remember she was, sullen, and she looked at us and said, "I'm not crazy. I don't belong here. I'm not crazy." And I told her, "You're absolutely right. You are not crazy. You are behaving actually in a very rational way. You're reacting to a crazy childhood. You've had a crazy childhood." And she agreed with me. "Oh, yes, I've had a crazy childhood." I said, "Okay, I would be behaving the same way you are behaving, and I would be sitting right where you're sitting, most likely, had I had your childhood. But I didn't. You did, and you're there." Now, the reverse of that, then, the inverse of that, I guess, would be, how would she be behaving and acting if I could make her childhood less crazy? If instead of constantly being exposed to dysfunction, violence, substance abuse, placement changes, other kids who are also behaving in a manner similar to her, what if I exposed her to kids who didn't have all that craziness in their lives? You know, would she start to behave differently? So I think that's where it became incumbent on me as her attorney. It kind of dawned on me as, you know, maybe I do have an obligation to do more than just, you know, fight the commitment of her in court to the only place that could possibly hope to contain her behaviors, and instead go to the root of the problem, which is she's just a kid who's reacting to a totally insane environment for the full 15 years of her life. What if I expose her to some sanity? Will we start to see some change in her behavior? And look, it's like a cruise ship sometimes with older youth, right? I mean, you turn the wheel and the ship doesn't start to turn until, you know, a mile down the sea, right? Down the lane. It takes a while to actually turn it around. But that, to me, is a critical part of getting the kids, is you don't wait for them to be stable to get them involved in stuff that might be more healthy and functional.
Well, and I think the underlying theme there is also bears repeating, which is that means that you, as their advocate, always hold on to what is best about them and find in them, you know, in this case, you were essentially saying you're responding in a perfectly reasonable way to, you know, that which is unreasonable. But in a lot of cases, you know, I think everybody just starts to speak so negatively about the child and, oh, they're running away and, oh, all these problems, instead of saying, you know what, this kid just needs a break. We just need to find a place to stop the noise and allow this child to settle in, and they can do it, and having faith in them and being the one, you know, outside of all the other professionals who've seen this happen a million times, looking at your single client and having faith that this could work. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But if you don't believe it and aren't willing to take a risk for them, then, you know, then it's just going to be like every other case.
Yeah. Yeah. I just was in a staffing this morning with a very good case manager, a very experienced case manager who was complaining about the teenage client, basically saying she will not take any accountability for her own actions. She constantly keeps getting herself in trouble, and all she wants to do is play the victim. She just plays the victim all the time. And I
you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah. And so I was covering the case, and I thought to myself, if I go read this girl's full file, I bet I'm going to find a lot of victimhood in that file, and I'm not going to wonder why she plays the victim. And so, you know, maybe the best way to get her out of that role, right, is to give her an opportunity to be something else, and it's not easy, right, with the older kids. And like I said, this is a great case manager. She's been with the kid for 5 years, and I could detect that she's, you know, kind of at the end of her rope with the kid. She loves the kid on one hand, but on the other hand, she's so tired of, and that's why I think we burn out with the older kids, is because we feel like we're banging our heads against a wall. And what I think we're proposing is implement our strategies with fidelity and let's try something different, right? Let's stop banging our heads against that same wall and let's try a different approach, even though it doesn't necessarily feel like they taught you how to do this in law school, right? It's still advocacy, and you're still bringing your critical thinking skills to a problem. And you will need to bring the court to bear on some of this stuff, and the case plan to bear on some of this stuff, and the agency and their responsibilities. You'll have to enforce stuff on, so your lawyer skills are still going to be required, probably, to implement some of these ideas that we're suggesting.
Well, for sure, because they're not going to be the typical ones. I kind of want to wrap up with one topic, and that is revisiting the birth family. You know, depending on the case, the age of the child, I mean, we know a lot of kids who age out go right back to their family, despite all the things that we've done. Where do you land on that issue?
Yeah, I think, again, permanency is going to look different. And just because the client is the only one who is pining for the birth family doesn't mean they're wrong. Maybe they were right all along, right? There's probably been files that you've read where you look back and you said, ooh, gee, if I could have a do-over, I would not have terminated her parental rights, because what did we do with the kid, right? We never got him adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, going back to the client I talked about earlier in the residential treatment center, I eventually did reach out to her her birth sister. Rights were terminated, but I found her older sister on Facebook. And through her older sister, I found her birth mother in, I think, in the hills of Tennessee, if I'm correct. And I called her up. You know, and it's a very hopeful call when you first make that call. You're hoping, you know, because I have found birth mothers who are like, oh, yeah, no, I've got a full-time job. I have two more kids since then. I'm raising them. I've had no DCF involvement. I'm clean now. I really regret, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, this is awesome. This one didn't work out quite like that. She was pretty much still in the bad situation she was in when she lost custody like 12 years ago or whatever. But she said something to me. She said, that's okay. You know, I said, I don't think I'm going to be able to ask for a home study on you. And she said something along the lines of, she goes, that's okay. They all come back to mama sooner or later. And I thought, well, you know, that is at the core of it, what some of the families believe and some of the kids believe too, is, you know, when I turn 18, some of the kids are going back to mama. And examining that earlier, if that's where they're going to be when they're 18 anyway, you know, if they're 15 or 16, the risk is different than when they were removed. And maybe mom or dad's problems are different as well. I mean, some of the fathers get terminated simply because they're absent, right? And they may not be completely. It's worth investigating for a kid who has no other family. It's certainly always worth going back and examining birth family and seeing if something can be done there, even just to build relations, especially when you know they're going to be back there anyway, because you can maybe start to build some healthier boundaries so that they don't just move in and immediately start supporting their birth parents' habit or whatever it may be. Because I've seen that as well, where the extended foster care payments and stuff are just used to pay the rent for the birth parents. So it's important. I think it's good to reach out and start establishing relationships and boundaries if that's what the kids want and if it can be done in a healthy way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, again, something that people, it's hard to do that because you're whether you were there or not, you're acknowledging system failure in many regards, or the positive way of looking at it is that we're giving second and third chances, whatever it takes for the child to have the best landing possible coming out of the system, I think is what we have to do. Well, we have only scratched the surface here. The representation of older youth has a lot of different facets. I just wanted to preview briefly for everybody what's coming up. We're going to, in the next few episodes, over the next few weeks, we're going to talk about building trust with your teenage clients and how important that is that you develop the strategy with them. We're also going to talk a little bit about the case plan and the services and benefits that the older youth need, and give you some not checklist, I guess, but just making sure that you're aware of what is likely available in your state so that we're setting the kids up as best we can. And then we're going to touch on what we call landmines on Permanency Road, which is just the barriers that often stand in the way of finding any form of permanency for youth who are older and in our system. So with that, we'll wrap up. I want to thank you all for listening. Also wanted to say that if you're interested in hearing more from us, we are sending emails now and you can subscribe via our website, which is childrenslaw.org, and you'll get a notice that the next episode is coming out and some notes on the show. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.